Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the COP28 meeting yielded new agreements on a loss and damage fund and a transition away from fossil fuels. But many of the previous agreements have yet to be implemented. What does it mean for addressing climate change? And what is the state of collective action? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. The latest climate change meetings, the COP or Conference of Parties 28, just ended in Dubai. After an initial pessimism about an agreement, with controversies over the leadership, the location of the meetings, there seemed to be some intriguing breakthroughs. But numerous issues remain unresolved. What exactly was accomplished by this meeting? And what remains on the agenda for future meetings, for future discussions, for implementation? On today's show, we're discussing the COP28 meetings. Our guests today are Pamela Chasek, professor of political science at Manhattan College. She's the author of several books, including Global Environmental Politics, and is the editor of the Earth Negotiations Bulletin for the International Institute for Sustainable Development. You can find these reports at www.iisd.org. Shannon Gibson, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies at the University of Southern California. She's the author of Don't Applaud the COP28 Climate Summit's Loss and Damage Fund Deal Just Yet. Here's What's Missing. You can find that at The Conversation. And she also runs the Gibson Climate Justice Lab at USC. And Lauren Gifford, Associate Director of the Soil Carbon Solutions Center and faculty in the Department of Ecosystem Science and Sustainability at Colorado State University. She's the author of numerous articles, including Safe and Just Earth System Boundaries and Impacts of Meeting Minimum Access on Critical Earth Systems Amidst the Great Inequality. Thank you all very, very much for joining us. What is actually becoming a bit of an annual show after these COP meetings, which makes sense since the COP meetings are annual themselves. Pam Chasek, let's start with you. What were the big broad goals that this COP meeting was hoping to meet, and did they meet them?
Well, the big thing to remember is that each annual meeting of the COP at this point has been focused on the implementation of the Paris Agreement, and particularly achieving the goal of keeping temperature rise below 1.5 degrees centigrade. So we're totally in implementation mode, and that was what was some of the main things were at this COP. So, for example, the first global stocktake took place this year. This was mandated under the Paris Agreement that for every 5 years, we would assess where we've been, what we're doing, and are we on our way to meeting that goal? The message of the synthesis report, the technical side of this sent to Dubai, was that the world must act now to avoid breaching 1.5 degrees centigrade and worse impacts. Countries must submit enhanced climate plans informed by this review. The private sector and financial institutions also have pivotal roles. So the response to the global stocktake was one. Clearly, that global emissions are not declining as rapidly as necessary. Dealing with what's called the global goal on adaptation was another part. So the first part is mitigation. We also now look at adaptation. And in 2015, the Paris Agreement established this global goal on adaptation with the aim of enhancing adaptive capacity, strengthening resilience, and reducing vulnerability to climate change. So developing this framework was a second goal. Operationalizing the Santiago Network on Loss and Damage and the Loss and Damage Fund, which I will leave to Shannon to discuss more. This was another piece of the puzzle for this meeting. And then, of course, what the press focused the most on was, should there be a phase out of fossil fuels? And that ties into a little bit what Lauren, I think, can speak about more, is the various loopholes on this phase out, which include other forms of capturing carbon to allow people to continue using fossil fuels. So I think what might be useful is maybe at the end of this discussion, we can assess, was it successful? But The one other piece I wanted to just bring in as part of the introduction was the media and a lot of NGOs and governments also focused on the fact that this COP was being held in the United Arab Emirates, which is a major fossil fuel producing country. And the one thing, though, to remember is that, you know, even though the president of the COP is, you know, responsible for oil and energy, who's in the United Arab Emirates, and there were a lot of things that were not so great about this. But at the same time, we have to remember that the COP presidency's main goal is to have what is perceived as a successful outcome, not for his or her country, but for the COP as a whole, because you don't want to be responsible for the failure of a COP. Just ask the Danes from the COP in Copenhagen in 2009. So their goal was not to 100% retain options for fossil fuels, as many people said, but rather to come up with some sort of a compromise that both the fossil fuel producing countries, those who want to phase down or phase out fossil fuel use, and the needs of developing countries would all be represented. On that point, I would say they were successful. Does this mean something good for the climate? Let's come back to that at the end.
And Shannon, it seems to me the location of the last two COPs in Egypt and then in Dubai have at least at one level wanted to emphasize the impact of rising global temperatures in areas that are particularly vulnerable, which is my way to transition to loss and damage. There's been so much emphasis on trying to address not climate change in the future, but the actual effects of climate change in the contemporary world. What is this loss and damage fund, and what was advanced at the meetings?
Yeah, so loss and damage funding, despite how it's been sometimes presented in the media, isn't new. This concept was introduced decades ago by small island nations as sort of what I would call a third pillar of climate funding. So we've had a focus on mitigation funding, which is looking at how do we provide finance for developing countries to begin reducing their emissions. Then the second pillar being adaptation funding, which is how do we build resilience against the changing climate? So allowing for countries to build seawalls, for example, or to transition their agriculture to be drought or heat resistant. And then loss and damage is really, as it is was initially conceived, about compensation. Now, that has become sort of a dirty word, a persona non grata in the negotiations, because developed countries don't like the idea of an obligation to pay for the damage that they've caused. But so loss and damage is really looking at how do we provide finance for developing countries that are currently and in the future will suffer from slow onset climate change events, so looking at rising sea levels, but also more sudden onset events such as floods, et cetera. So that's the reason behind this third fund. And it was proposed, again, decades ago. It's been a long, hard fought issue for developing countries and vulnerable island states. And it was sort of, it came to fruition in more recent COPs, but this was really about operationalizing it. Because on the one hand, you can have fund, you know, those letters written on a piece of paper, but then you need who's going to run it, who's going to fund it, who's going to make decisions about who qualifies, how it gets dispersed. And so really at this COP, we were looking at a couple of different things, first being that initial capitalization. So how much money were we going to raise, which in my assessment is, you know, it's gotten a lot of fanfare in the media, but it's not enough. I think at last we started off the COP with around 400 million in contributions. And then by the time we ended, it was up to 600 and something billion. The United States initial offer was 17 million, I believe. Which one of my students noted, well, that's about the price of a house in Los Angeles. You know, and so the one, we can look at how much money's going into it, but then there's the devil's always in the details. And so I'll stop there and see if we have others who want to chime in and get into kind of like what the fund looks like and what are some of the not so savory aspects of how it's been created.
I think this term devil's in the details will be coming up throughout this this podcast.
I would like to highlight one thing. Shannon, you said, was it 600 million is what has been committed to the fund?
That was the last I checked. I don't know if someone has an updated
Yeah, no,
number.
I would just like to point out that a recent baseball contract was signed for 700 million for a single individual, just
Yes.
as a point of reference for these sorts of issues. We're going to return to that, but I do want to bring Lauren Gifford into the conversation. Loss and damage is really an adaptability question. The realization that climate change has happened, is going to happen, and we need to address this. The other side of that coin is mitigation, the steps that we take to try to limit climate change. And that I know was definitely reported on quite a bit, that there were focuses on mitigation, on phasing down, phasing out, addressing questions about fossil fuels. What was accomplished there?
I'm still trying to answer that question myself, Doug. But I think, one thing I think is in order to understand and order all the information and contextualize all the information that we have coming out of these contexts, we tend to silo things and is this adaptation, is this mitigation? But in actuality, a lot of the mitigation is funding adaptation and things like that. It's not this binary that it seems to be in policy discourses. So I tend to track carbon markets, but not necessarily from a policy wonk perspective, but more of a critical social scientist perspective. Even asking like, what is a carbon credit with like, is italicized and, stars on both sides? Like, what are we trading here? And, these negotiations really get in the weeds to have UN-led standards. You've probably heard, if you've been following the COP, you've heard this term Article 6, right? These are US-led standards that sort of inform carbon trading, and that were not agreed upon this year. And what happens is every year carbon trading gets bigger and bigger. These markets are larger scale, and I think the UN body is trying to sort of meet the markets where they are and troubleshoot, but at the same time, the actual compliance markets and these voluntary carbon markets that the UN is informing are just kind of moving ahead on their own without this UN-informed advisory, or oversight and standards. So to say, what happened? Like I said, still processing that. I went into the COP thinking that loss and damage was going to be the thing that was going to get me riled up and really pissed off. And it settled quite quickly in the early part of the first week. And I actually think that was a political tool, right? Like, let's appease the small island states, let's appease the folks in the global south, let's appease the activists, give them what they want. Pam's raising her hand. Do you want to just jump in, Pam?
No, I was just going to say it's not only to appease them, but to start off with a win. And that politically, that was super important for the presidency, was to start off with a win. So all the work that had been done in the working group on this, which met up until just before the COP started to reach agreement so that they could start the COP with a fanfare while the presidents were the, and the high level people were there. And so that I think was even bigger than appeasing the small island states.
Yeah, absolutely. This is why we have a good roundtable here, because I love everyone's got insights here. And there are people who can talk about this. Well, Shannon's one of them, right? But better than me, and Teresa Anderson at ActionAid, Assad Rehman, there are folks who are much more articulate than this. But one thing I think we need to note is that there are commitments made to loss and damage. But we know that these commitments, if we look at the Green Climate Fund and how that has behaved or, sort of unrolled over the years, just because someone makes a commitment doesn't mean they're going to pay to it. And just because there's a fund doesn't mean it's going to be distributed equitably.
Listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Today's show is all about a recap of the COP28 meetings, the issues on climate change, with Pam Chasek of Manhattan College, Shannon Gibson of the University of Southern California, and Lauren Gifford of Colorado State University. And Shannon, you are going to jump in.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think that there were some good points made about kind of the optics of the COP, which has become as much, if not as important, as what happens in the COP. And so we've gotten into this tradition of the first day or so since they've switched the high-level segment from the end of the COP to the beginning of it becoming kind of like announcement week. It's fanfare week. And so I think it was certainly well orchestrated, or at least purposely orchestrated, you know, to have that big announcement in the beginning, to kind of like pave the way for this being, as it's been dubbed over and over by the presidency themselves, the most, you know, the most comprehensive and successful COP to date. Even though we should note that it's been, we've had 28 of these. And so what I think is interesting, one thing I was thinking about the other day was that, you know, every COP kind of gets like its moniker. There's the Island COP, the Implementation COP. To me, this felt a lot like the rebranding COP, of taking a lot of what has been around and, you know, everything new is old, and really re packaging and rebranding things. So, you know, instead of the phase out, phase down controversy of last year, now we have transitioning away from fossil fuels, right? And then even with the loss and damage fund, there's already this move to transition and to rebrand that as a climate impact fund. Because of course, if I damage your car, that sounds so much worse than if I accidentally impacted your car in an automobile, an automobile accident, right? And so I think that's one thing that's been from a framing, and for those of us like social scientists from a constructivist point of view, is looking at how language has been so purposefully utilized to paint things as wins that necessarily aren't like hard, solid wins for especially frontline and impacted communities.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Lauren, you had a response as well.
So I wasn't there in person, but what I was hearing from colleagues is that there were influencers there. Possibly hired from industry like nuclear and things like that, R young folks who were very social media savvy, who were, you know, very trendy, and they were able to sort of be on panels and speak for like the nuclear industry. And this speaks to what Shannon was saying about rebranding, right? Like, get someone young, get someone with this like quote unquote fresh perspective to sort of make nuclear the new clean solution in this discourse. Really, really interesting to me. And you know, I'd love to sit down with some media scholars and see what do we make of that, right? Like climate influencers.
And Pam Chase, this kind of raises this larger issue too, because of course these meetings take place in a political context. We have a political context where there's more and more knowledge of awareness of climate change, but I've heard from a number of scholars and number of analysts saying it's not really climate denialism; it's more like climate reductionism, if you will. We acknowledge it, but there's only so much that we can do. So how much of this branding is really covered by, the political discourses that we're currently having, certainly here in the United States, but throughout the world, and trying to figure out a way to make climate action politically advantageous?
That's a tough one because I think, on the one hand, the major issues with climate denialism are in the US, not so much the rest of the world. Even in the oil-producing states, you know, they're affected by climate change, most definitely, and recognize this. What they've been trying to do, and Saudi Arabia has really been trying to do this since the very beginning on behalf of the oil producing states, is to say that, fine, but if we have to reduce our production of fossil fuels, then we should get adaptation benefits because we have to adapt our economy. And, you know, which broadens the whole definition of climate change adaptation. And that's been a big sticking point for as long as I can remember. And so, with what I think is more of the challenge is that for many people and countries around the world, we have a certain lifestyle. That lifestyle, unfortunately, is very dependent upon fossil fuels. Our agriculture sector, you know, not just drug, you know, agriculture and transportation and shipping and everything, not just how we do it at home. And the fossil fuel industry has been very successful about getting individuals to think about their individual climate footprint or carbon footprint, rather than putting the blame back on them for creating that this is a systemic issue. You know, we can reduce our carbon dioxide emissions as much as we want as an individual, but it's not going to make a difference if our global economy and our health and our food systems and everything else is so inextricably linked to carbon emissions. So the biggest challenge politically is for leaders, you know, sure, we can talk about our need to keep climate change or temperature rises below 1.5 degrees C, but how are we going to do it without changing our whole global economy? And that's the challenge. That's a political as well as an economic challenge.
Oh, absolutely. Shannon, you had some thoughts too.
Yeah, I mean, I think we started this conversation, you know, with is this a success, right? And I think one way of measuring that is looking at who's saying it's a success. And if the majority of fossil fuel companies and lobbyists like Shell and Exxon and Chevron are saying this is a success, that should give us pause, right? And that's because, yes, we've agreed to this idea of a transition away from fossil fuels under the Global Stocktake Text. But there's no definition of what a transition means. There's no timeline, right? And so then again, like Lauren said, the devil in the details for those of us that pore over these texts and are analyzing what changes from night to night, you know, the idea that now we're embracing zero to low emission technologies, right? These are code words for carbon capture, utilization, and storage. Low carbon hydrogen, or the rainbow of hydrogen as it's being called, right? A lot of these are built on the fossil fuel industry's rebranding tactics to shift us away from the idea of leaving oil, coal, and gas in the ground to saying, how can we just reduce these emissions over time without acknowledging that, sure, we can capture carbon as it's being emitted during extraction. But then what about the fact that most of that captured carbon then gets used to extract more fossil fuels, right? So again, when we're thinking about success, we have to think about who's trumpeting this as such a landmark consensus. And that should kind of point you to how really progressive, and you can't see me using hand quotes, but I am, it really may be.
And by the way, the idea of transitioning away from fossil fuels is inevitable no matter what, because they're non-renewable, and that we know the fossil fuel companies have been doing research to figure out ways to remain profitable once they eventually, run out of the fossil fuel. So how much of this language is a recognition of reality that isn't really changing anything? It's an inevitability. Lauren, you were going to respond.
Yeah, and sorry for constantly using the word discourse, but I'm glad that we're in a podcast on a podcast called Scholar Circle. So then it seems like a appropriate term. But some of the critical social science on this says, success, I'm using the air quotes that Shannon used, right, is often only exists in discourse, right? Like, look at the numbers, look at the increased atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, right? Like, we actually haven't been making the dent that, people who call the COP a success think that we are, right? Like, we're reaching catastrophic tipping points. I'm an author of one of this recent global tipping points report with 200 scholars from around the world, and we talk about these, multitude of catastrophic tipping points that we are reaching, like, ice sheets melting that we can't return from, and we're getting closer there every day. And we talk about what's a positive tipping point to sort of counteract that. It doesn't, no one's bringing the ice sheets back, right? It's a positive tipping point is sort of like more democratic governance structures. So I think, what does success mean? And are we even thinking about the atmosphere when we say that a COP was successful? It's successful for major corporations, great. Successful for humanity and the atmosphere, probably not.
Absolutely. And Pam, I know we've spoken about this before, about the 1.5 degree target from Paris. It seems like every COP, the message is the same, which is it's really becoming more and more unlikely we're going to be able to, to meet the one, the 1.5. But if we do something immediately now, maybe we can. Is that political, or are we just is the 1.5 we're racing past that? We should just kind of focus on, on 2 degrees, or how successful is this discourse?
Using the word discourse again.
Exactly.
So At every COP, everyone reaffirms their commitment to keeping to 1.5. Now, originally, the Paris Agreement wanted to say 2 degrees, and the small island developing states really pushed for putting in the goal of 1.5, if possible. We're not going to make it. I can pretty much tell you that now. That's out of question. But politically, the governments have to come forth and say we are still committed to that target because nobody, wants to admit failure. One of the reasons COP meetings go as long as they do and go overtime, the record is held as 44 hours overtime, nearly 2 days, is so that it does not end in failure. That word is anathema. I love being able to use that word. Anathema to policymakers. You never want to admit failure. You'll do whatever you can to show that there is some success, to say that, that this process is working. We are getting there. We're committed. We're going to do what we can. But as Shannon said, with the loss and damage fund, commitments does not necessarily political co commitments or even financial commitments doesn't necessarily equate action that needs to be taken.
When we come back, can climate change activists persuade states and public leaders to slow rising temperatures and mitigate the effects of climate change? If so, how can they? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What would make the COP meetings more effective? And should they even continue? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing the most recent the Conference of Parties meetings, the COP28 in Dubai. How much should we focus on new agreements versus just implementing the existing agreements? And what can we do to increase commitment to implementation? Our guests today are Pam Chasick. She's a professor of political science at Manhattan College. Shannon Gibson is an associate professor of environmental studies at the University of Southern California. And Lauren Gifford, the director of the Soil Carbon Solutions Center and on the faculty in the Department of Ecosystem Science and Sustainability at Colorado State University. So let's focus on these commitments. First of all, actually, Lauren, I'll start with you because one of the areas of those commitments is in this carbon trading model. First of all, before we talk about the commitments, let's talk about the model itself a little bit, because my understanding was it was a pretty uniquely American approach. And the idea was to build in a market mechanism, even a profit mechanism, so that companies or actors could profit from being greener. Is that accurate?
Yeah, so accurate except for the US centric part. So one of the oldest and most established compliance markets in the world is the European Emissions Trading System, which was initially called the European Emissions Trading Scheme, but it sounded too sinister. So those of us who like to critique capitalism like to sort of highlight that rebranding, back to Shannon's rebranding. But this was a way to incentivize industrial polluters to lower their emissions and provide an opportunity to profit through that process, right? So that's why, we often call carbon trading cap and trade It's no cap, there's just no carbon cap, right? Because that's a command to just cap your carbon emissions. But cap and trade allows for flexibility and it allows for profit-seeking activities. What started actually in the 90s as a way to commodify carbon, and you know, I think it's important to first say what is traded. No one's actually physically handing someone else a ton of carbon. We're trading agreed upon representations of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. So we have to make that carbon pollution or sequestered carbon in soils or you know, in trees and things like that. We have to make them legible on financial markets and then also on financial ledgers. So when we see targets like 1.5, and governments say we're going to stick to this 1.5 target, that means that they're going to organize their climate policy to sort of meet and carbon budgets and carbon ledgers to sort of reflect what a 1.5 degree increase, global temperature increase would look like. So there's a lot of representations, but that also creates space for a lot of fraud, a lot of misconceptions, a lot of contention.
And the follow-up is, if what's being traded, because my understanding is, at least in the American context, there were certificates that were being traded or you know, could be sold as a way to try to profit from that. Sounds like I'm describing it a bit more with a bit more kind of a physical manifestation, you know, as far as the certificates. And if that's not the case, I guess the big broad question is, has it been successful?
Well, I think, and again, you have a critical social scientist here, so this isn't, you know, this is other people would disagree with me. But when we say is carbon trading successful, I think it's really important to say successful for whom? Because it has been successful for large-scale corporate polluters. It has been successful for some early adopters who have invested in the space. So financially successful. For the environment, I don't believe it has been successful. Right. We, like I said earlier, we have not lowered atmospheric concentrations of CO2. Shannon, go ahead. You've got your hand up.
Yeah, please, Shannon.
And I was going to say, too, I mean, when we think about carbon trading, this is based on offsetting, right? And so if our ultimate goal is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, that's predicated on the idea of what Lauren was talking about, which is a cap, which will progressively get stronger and lower over time, which we have not achieved under the Paris Agreement, right? So what we're doing is we're literally just moving theoretical carbon emissions. And I assign one of Lauren's articles in my class, and it's such a mind-blowing article to students because it boils down to how do we trade what we can't measure, right? And so when we look at this idea of what may work in theory, but then in practice, what this has done, and they're rightfully called flexible mechanisms, is provided flexibility for our major climate culprits, right? For those who want to continue to emit, to continue to extract fossil fuels by offsetting their emissions, by providing financial support in developing countries, by saying that they're sinking their carbon, you know, in the Amazon's Brazil or in the forests in Africa. And so that's the problem. And one of the other things I wanted to bring up again, going back to success and measuring how far we've come, is that one of the things that we debated a lot in my classes this semester is, do we have the right target? Like by picking 1.5 and 2, was that scientifically based or was that just politically meat, like a nice little package? Because when you think about public policy, right, and how we go about seeking social change and improving outcomes, if you think about the idea of like, okay, what if we wanted to improve life expectancy? Would we really say like our global goal is to improve, like to get a global life expectancy of 80? No, that's not what we did in the MDGs and the SDGs. Instead, we pick very specific metrics, right? Reducing under 5 mortality, improving outcomes for maternal health. By picking this goal of 1.5 and 2, and then allowing every country to figure out how you math that out and what that looks like for each individual country, I think is what's gotten us into a lot of the mess that we're in. Because getting to a 1.5 degree world, there's so much room for different assumptions and different preferences and interests. And so again, thinking about what are the overall goals that we're seeking to achieve, we kind of created a very fuzzy, hard achievable a goal to start with.
And Pam, you had some response to that as well.
I have response to a lot. Let me try to pick. Just building off the last point by Sharon very quickly is that in the Earth Negotiations Bulletin summary of COP28, we actually equated the Paris Agreement to Frankenstein, and that we've created, Mary Shelley's book, and that we've created this monster, and we're not quite sure how to manage our creation. This monster called the Paris Agreement, and that this first global stocktake was to sort of assess, is this working? And building on what both Shannon and Lauren have said, on the first part, are we going to, achieve these goals, these climate goals? And, rightfully so. No, we're not on our way to doing that. It's possible that the part of the monster that allows these nationally determined contributions, which is countries determining what their own pathways are going to be, which was necessary, by the way, because the top-down approach of the Kyoto Protocol did not work. So let's try the bottom-up approach and see if that works. And right now, according to the global stocktake, no, that the nationally determined contributions or NDCs are not working. So second point on the targets, the 1.5 and the 2.0, this was followed up after Paris by a request to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the science policy body, to actually do a report on climate change at 1.5 and to look to provide the scientific backing to these goals. And even in the most the special report on 1.5, as well as the most recent IPCC assessment report, the sixth assessment report, basically show how the impacts of climate change get progressively worse with each, gradation of temperature increase. So if we don't stop things at 1.5 and go to 2, maybe we have a chance of saving life on the planet as we know it. If we go above 2, it really looks bad. And the science now is there to back up those goals. Finally, my third point, and this is in addition to carbon trading, the other loophole that is firmly in place here and was codified in the global stocktake decision is playing around with different technologies, including these carbon removal technologies like carbon capture and utilization and carbon capture and storage, both of which are untested, to be perfectly honest. But those technologies are another way to allow governments to keep spewing carbon dioxide emissions in theory, without having to cut production of fossil fuels, and just saying, oh no, we can just capture and bury it underground. And I can recommend someone if you want to talk to about that who's really good, and that's Will Burns.
No, absolutely. Shannon, you want to respond?
And let's not forget that not even that, they still haven't even touched on some of the what I would call more nefarious aspects of geo or climate engineering, like solar radiation management, right? So th there's nothing explicitly in the Paris Agreement or previous climate agreements that limit our exploration of some of those other types of technological solutions. And one thing that we know in the UN and particularly in Western discourse is that we tend to be very techno-optimistic, right? We really want to find that silver bullet that we can utilize as opposed to, radically altering our ways of life and our capitalist economic system. And so I think that's going to be a big thing to watch moving forward, is that if we continue to miss the mark, which the global stocktake has shown that we have done, that there are going to be more and more actors in this space pitching those silver bullet ideas that really run the risk of, opening the doors to some of these experimentations and solutions that could radically alter our ecosystem and our climate in ways that we can't predict, because radiative forcing is such a tricky issue. And I'm not a natural scientist, but I know enough to know that we can't predict what some of these things could do long term. And so I think that's another thing to really watch in the COPs to come.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're doing a recap of the most recent climate change meetings, the COP28 meetings in Dubai with Pam Chasek of Manhattan College, Shannon Gibson of the University of Southern California, and Lauren Gifford of Colorado State University. And Shannon, I guess I'll ask this of you, but I'm kind of asking of all of you. And at the end of the day, it seems like these issues really are political and social in nature. The need to make political changes, social changes, so that we're addressing, the impact of climate change and trying to mitigate and potentially adapt to that. One thing that we've seen the last year and a half is a different way to think about climate change. And instead of talking about global warming, increasing temperatures, I mean, those certainly are on the agenda. Extreme weather seems to be, at least from a political perspective, a way to understand that. But at one level, from a scientific level, weather and climate aren't exactly the same. So how do you speak of extreme weather and the impacts of climate change without giving the meteorologists political factors the argument saying, you know what, it's really cold today, climate change must be a hoax?
In this case, and again, I'm not a natural scientist, so getting into the weeds on the difference between weather and climate is not necessarily my wheelhouse. But in a lot of cases, what I do is take signals from civil society, right, and looking at frontline communities, vulnerable populations, and rather than speak of extreme weather events, what we can do is look at the lived experiences, right, that communities are going through at this time. And one thing that we heard over and over, because I watched and my students that were following the talks watched, were dozens of press conferences and side events of Indigenous peoples, local communities, women farmers, et cetera, testifying, bearing witness to the fact that their lives have changed, right? And whether it's called extreme climate or extreme weather event or it's called climate change, there's no denying those lived experiences and that traditional knowledge. And I think that's one of the things that unfortunately gets lost in a lot of this, because the predominant speakers, those who tend to get the microphone, who tend to get the headlines, are those of us who lived in privileged existences where we don't experience climate change in the same way, right? So us being in California, Doug, right? We had our tropical storm Hillary. We've had these fires. We've had all these things. But as you and I know, as people who own cars but that don't walk to work, that live in homes that have, that are weatherized so that we don't get smoke and soot in our houses, our experience is quite different. And so one thing that's been good about the COPs is that they are, we're seeing increasing voices being highlighted from these communities. But still, unfortunately, in the media, a lot of times those aren't covered quite as much.
And Shannon, I also want to tag on there the part of privilege is the financial mechanisms like insurance, right? So I live in Louisville, Colorado. A year and a half or 2 years ago, almost, we had a fire where we lost 1,000 homes on New Year's Eve. Really, really horrific. Caused by drought, incredibly high winds that, they couldn't get planes up to fight the fire, and the fire spread really rapidly because of high winds, right? This is an extreme weather event that then, in an urban area, right? So it's this urban interface, urban wildland interface, where the extreme weather events have wild implications beyond, beyond a forest fire in a less habited area. But people have insurance and they've been able to rebuild. Many people, r the renters who lived in the area, have by and large been displaced. So, I think it's not just actual money, but there's also sort of mechanisms and infrastructure that allow some people to be more resilient than others. And that is a another just one more injustice or justice complication that we need to think about.
And Lauren, to follow that quickly, in the United States, for example, it seems that government decisions about where to build, where to rebuild, et cetera, should probably be made by government officials, but they can't. They can't, they won't. And so instead, the decisions are being made, but they're being made by market mechanisms like insurance.
And
And
zone,
where's the justice in that?
even zoning or calling something a floodplain, right? These become political. And one of the scariest things I ever saw was a map of Miami. And I know Shannon's from South Florida, but a map of Miami that had a poor community shown as one of the highest, above sea level communities in Miami. And right there, you put a target there for dispossession and displacement of those people, And so sometimes I wonder how much data is good data, or I don't know. Pam, go ahead. I see you.
Pam, you're going to respond as well.
No, I was just going to say Liberty City in Miami, which, you know, is traditionally a place where African Americans and other people of color live because it was far from the coastline and nobody else wanted to live there. And now they are being displaced because people who live in the floodplain, which is most of Miami, which is flooding at high tides almost on a daily basis, are moving to the higher ground, which is there, and they are pushing out the people who currently live there. And so, you know, we have to remember for every single environmental problem, climate change among them, obviously, is that for every solution, there are additional problems. And it's not, I just finished teaching a course on environmental politics, and I told them there is no perfect solution. There's no perfect solution to anything because every possible solution can have unintended consequences on other people or other ecosystems, biodiversity, land, agriculture, health, human health.
And Shannon, you were going to respond as well.
Yeah. And then just to kind of like put an irony bow on all of this is that, speaking of Florida, right? So we have in Florida, after that 2005 hurricane season where we had Wilma, Rita, Katrina, all the insurance companies started dropping everybody. And the government had to come in and require to physically mandate that insurance companies continue to provide people, or if you made a claim on your house, that you couldn't be dropped for your car insurance and that you had to offer flood insurance. And so we've seen insurance not work effectively in the United States. But when you look at the loss and damage fund and some of the financial mechanisms that are being proposed, one of them is this horrific portmanteau called Insure Resilience, which is also now being called like the Global Shield. But now they're pitching climate insurance to developing countries. So again, taking a Western model, which we've seen has a lot of problems, and now pushing it on developing countries. And in that case, it's almost offensive to the idea that developing countries or small island states would be paying climate insurance premiums. But again, these are the loopholes. These are the things that we're seeing being worked into the agreements, being rebranded as solutions. And so it's why it's always important to pay attention to every time there's some new innovative project or proposal being pitched, look at who's hawking it, right? And to what benefit.
And actually, it makes me think of, you know, the brilliant Diana Liverman has used the term, and so have others, climate colonialism. Right. And imposing Western financial structures onto cultures and communities that might not even exist in this form is a type of colonialism. Right. The sort of pay for protection. And again, like, you know, my family lives in Fiji. They are not going to be paying for climate insurance. They don't even have air conditioning. Like, I don't know. That is which is actually a form of climate insurance in some ways.
I want to go around and give you each about 2 minutes. If you could add or emphasize one point that should go on the COP29 agenda, what do you think should be the focus going forward? We'll start with you, Pam.
The focus going forward right now has to be continued implementation, but also governments have to start putting together the next round of their nationally determined contributions. And these NDCs have to be seriously scaled up from existing NDCs. And I think there needs to be pressure on governments to, particularly high emitting countries. The US and China have reached a tentative agreement on this, but they're top of the list, but other countries as well, in terms of how are we going to put more effort into reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. Without that, this whole house of cards is going to collapse, and that means our planet. So I think right now that's the primary focus, and I think NGOs, others, everyone needs to put pressure and influence on governments to seriously up their commitments. This is just within, I'm just talking within the COP process.
No, absolutely. Shannon, your thoughts.
I think for me, my continued focus is just equity and legitimate participation by civil society. I think every COP that I go to, we see more and more sort of performative Access and consultation by civil society. And we can't let it be forgotten that, you know, this year at this COP, there were some 2,500 lobbyists from the fossil fuel industry. This outnumbered the 10 most vulnerable climate nations combined. It dwarfed the indigenous delegation, something like 6 or 7 to 1. And I know we always say, like, bring more voices to the table, amplify marginalized voices, but this actually matters in the process, because when we watch the global stocktake decision be taken, the Alliance of Small Island States wasn't even in the room, right? They had to come back and say, we weren't here when that decision was made, and we want to raise objections. Bolivia raised objections. Cuba brought up multiple times in plenaries that meetings were being scheduled overlapping with one another so that nations with smaller delegations could not effectively participate in these talks. And so I think we need to continue to highlight these gaps and power imbalances that exist within this United Nations system.
And that's a reminder of one of my favorite lines when I teach negotiations, which is, if you're not at the table, you're usually on the menu. And so the need for representation, absolutely. Lauren, I'm going to give you the last word on this.
I think it's important to say, what's the point of the COP at this point, right? And maybe critically examine, Pam, I'm sorry, I feel like that got, Pam's going to actually have the last word now. But sort of, what's the point of the COP beyond this ongoing performance of global politics, beyond this performance of commitment and ambition, right? Because that doesn't always translate to action. And how can we utilize the COP process to contribute to actual reductions and reduction on the reliance of extraction and combustion of fossil fuels, right? Like, how do we actually move away from both exacerbating, you know, continuing to contribute to the climate crisis, and how do we work on solving it in equitable ways?
And Pam, I will give you the last word with your reaction there. Should we continue with the COPs?
I think we should continue with COPs. We have to totally rethink them. Right now, the agendas are way out of control. There is a group of people who are working on how can we significantly reduce the work streams, the amount of stuff that's being done. The carbon cost of these COPs has gotten huge as each one tries to outdo the next. Oh, we want to be the biggest one. We want to be the best one. And that also has to go away. And there's a lot of people who attended this COP who were, you know, who flew in and out very quickly, a number of them on private jets. It just, you know, it's the place to see and be seen and to have your side event and to have your action and everything else, which is fine. It draws global attention. And we need global attention to climate change, but this may not be the way. But we can't totally dismiss the international agreements that we have and dismiss a forum where, despite certain inequities, every country does have a seat at the table. And that needs to continue, but some reforms are definitely needed.
Absolutely. And it makes me think of somebody who teaches on negotiations. I always like to point out, first of all, when the cameras are running, I always like to say the most dangerous place, you know, to be in Washington, D.C. is between a senator and a camera. And that if the cameras are running, frequently the serious negotiations aren't necessarily taking place. That a lot of the really serious negotiations, the roll up your sleeves, let's make some serious concessions. Let's actually explore some really fundamentally different ways to approach these issues are essential. So whether or not the COP covers it is necessary. There's no doubt that global meetings to address these issues that are open and transparent, so that it's not just government representation, but civil society, those who are impacted, all have an impact, I think are absolutely essential. Kind of raises the question, was it a big deal that President Biden didn't show up and so many world leaders didn't show up? And I found that one to be probably, and I'm seeing a lot of shaking heads, also one of the least interesting questions that was raised. What I wanted to know is, you know, how are these things being addressed? Are there different ways to approach it? And I guess the really difficult thing is, I'm of course asking you to assess the COP meetings a couple of weeks after they end, or, you know, week and a half after they end, when in reality, the real assessment is going to take place 6 months, a year, 2, 3 years from now. And to think of the COPs as an entire process. And as part of a process, this is becoming a bit of an annual show for us. And I want to thank our guests today as we've been discussing a recap of the COP28 meetings and an urging as we go forward into 2024 broadly that we need to do something more. We need to be much more committed to addressing climate change. Our guests today have been Pamela Chasek. She's professor of political science at Manhattan College. She's the author of several books, including Global Environmental Politics. She's also the editor of the Earth Negotiations Bulletin for the International Institute for Sustainable Development. You can find that at www.iisd.org. I really recommend that strongly. Shannon Gibson, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies at the University of Southern California. And I'm very proud to say a colleague of mine, both in that field, in that department, and in international relations. She's the author of Don't Applaud the COP28 Climate Summit's Loss and Damage Fund deal just yet. Here's What's Missing. And that's currently in the conversation. She also runs the Gibson Climate Justice Lab at USC. I'd like to note as well, brings students that with the opportunity to experience the COP meetings, which I think is just a wonderful pedagogical tool, teaching tool. And Lauren Gifford, the Associate Director of the Soil Carbon Solutions Center and faculty in the Department of Ecosystem Science and Sustainability at Colorado State University. She is the author of numerous articles to the, I pulled the names from Safe and Just Earth System Boundaries and Impacts of Meeting Minimum Access on Critical Earth Systems Amidst the Great Inequality. I want to thank you all very much for joining us, for sharing your expertise, and just enlightening us on these issues. Thank you very much.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on at Scholar Circle or me at Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.